This week, Bitcoin blasted through 8,000, while gold and silver closed at the highest levels in over 1 month. Welcome to GoldSeek.com Radio, everyone. Just great to be back with you this weekend. Chris Waltzek, your host, with another edutainment-packed show. Well, with the holiday season just around the corner, it looks like Santa may have come really early this year, at least for Bitcoin investors. Nerd money briefly shot through 8,000, recovering from a post-SegWit2x cancellation last week, where price actually fell under 5,500, only to roar back this week to new highs. You can keep up with all the latest crypto news on my Alpha Stocks Bitcoin newsletter. Plus, we still have a few free Ledger wallets left for each new annual subscription, 2 for 5-year subscribers, and 3 wallets for 10-year subscriptions. So you'll want to take advantage of this if you've been on the sidelines and sign up for an annual or 5-10-year subscription. This weekend's big show includes 2 new guest interviews. Alternative economist John Williams, friend of the show from ShadowStats.com. He sees economic Armageddon on both horizons. With over $100 trillion in U.S. obligations, the national debt simply cannot be repaid, he says. Actual inflation is much higher, at least those of us who pump our own gasoline, unlike our Fed heads who probably have their limo drivers pay the gas bill. John Williams expects more dollar selling and weaker economic conditions, and so far he's been spot on with the U.S. dollar collapsing in the last 12 months. Then Louis Navalier, another longtime friend of the show, says investors should ignore the naysayers. U.S. equities will continue to rally soon back into the holiday season. Investors just can't shake their appetite for big equities dividend payments. He shares my outlook for at least 24,000 on the Dow in the next few months, and we discuss several of his favorite stock candidates. Then Robert Ian wraps up the show with his latest report. And remember, we'd like to field your questions and comments. We have a hotline, 641-715-3900. I'd like for you to jot this down, please. You'll need the mailbox number, too. So the number, 641-715-3900, mailbox number 5140-49. You can call 24/7. GoldSeek.com Radio begins now with the market weather recap. Mostly sunny skies appeared over the precious metals market this week. On U.S. dollar weakness, gold recorded the best gain in 5 weeks, silver as well, while platinum posted the strongest daily gain since midsummer. Gold picked up 22, finishing at 1267, with its eyes firmly on the $1,300 resistance. Silver picked up 50 cents, finishing at 1737 an ounce. The precious metals XAU shares gained marginally, finishing around 81, while black gold finished at break even at 5670 a barrel. The Bitcoin ETF picked up 26, closing at 905, well over 620% for the year. The key story moving the precious metals this week, U.S. dollar weakness on the biggest change in the tax code since the 1980s. On Thursday, the U.S. House of Representatives passed legislation to overhaul the tax code. While the bill faces serious challenges from the Senate Finance Committee, the news did offset the upcoming Fed funds futures rate hike, which currently stands at 91.5% odds, so virtually a lock on higher rates this December at the next FOMC meeting. Meanwhile, in a speech on Thursday, the Cleveland Fed President Loretta Mester said that she expected a gradually higher path for the short-term interest rate. Still, many pundits are calling for the end of the rate hike cycle. But if you really look closer at the Fed funds futures contracts at the St. Louis Fed's website, it really indicates probably another quarter point rate hike by as soon as June or August. Those odds 2-1. So it looks like the Fed president might have the upper hand. In Bitcoin news, nerd money climbed to over 8,000. Bullish sentiment continues to pick up on expectations of Bitcoin IRAs, some calling this a top, while others such as Cliff High, who has been amazingly prescient in recent months and years, says his web bots are calling for 10,000 and even 13,000 within just the next 3 months or so. Precious metals, bottom line. Well, investors clearly turned to the shares in bullion amid dollar weakness and the threat of higher inflation with this red-hot domestic economy plowing forward like it's running on diesel. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, partly cloudy skies were seen over the New York Stock Exchange on less than robust unemployment numbers and dissension in the ranks over the much-anticipated U.S. corporate tax plan. The Dow Jones dropped 64, closing at 23,358. Still on target for 24,000. The S&P gave back just 3.5, finishing at 25.79, while the NASDAQ finished nearly at break-even, off only about 10 at 67.82. Meanwhile, U.S. jobless claims leaped to a six-week high on news that the Philadelphia Fed's manufacturing index fell to a reading of 22.7 in November, down from 27.9 in October. It made equities investors fret over imminent rate hikes and how that might put downward pressure on corporate profits and share prices. Bottom line on U.S. equities. Our favorite USA Today 7 indicator greed fear index is solidly back in the neutral column. So now there, as I mentioned last week, plenty of room for the bull to regain the upper hand here, and we're still on track for 24,000. Coming up after the break, more Gold Seek Radio. Gold recently topped 1,300, the highest point in months on news the Fed might hold rates steady for the foreseeable future. Joining us with his outlook on the precious metals and the domestic economy, head of ShadowStats, an alternative economic think tank. Welcome back, John Williams.
Thank you for having me, Chris. I was hoping that with a change in a government, we might see a change in Congress and a serious effort to address the economic and budget issues that are really threatening the survival of the United States as we know it, but you've had a circumstance where the Congress has just got bogged down, and I think it may be another election before we get things maybe turned around. I hope things get turned around. When Mr. Trump was elected, effectively a mandate from a fair portion of the populace to change the direction of the economy. And problem was that where you got a change in the presidency, you really didn't get much of a change in the Congress. We had a lot of ingrained people there from really 30 years of drifting away from national interest. Can't change that overnight. You have a Congress that is been difficult to work with for the president. He's not approached things necessarily the way I would have, but I think the circumstances here very, very simply are that the U.S. is in long-term fiscal disaster. I mean, if you look at the net worth of the United States, or not the net worth, the net obligations, net present value of those obligations into the future, what do you need in the way of cash today to cover what the government's committed to spend over the years ahead? What would you need in the bank today to cover that? You're looking at something order of magnitude $100 trillion. Just no way that can be covered. So that effectively you're looking at the United States from a standpoint of long-term sovereign solvency as not being solvent. That's going to become, and it's we've had spates of problems with that, but that's going to become a dominant issue in the markets going forward here. I guess there was some distraction from the near collapse of the banking system in 2008 that refocused circumstances a little bit, but nothing much has changed since then. We shouldn't have gotten to that point that the banking system was on the brink of collapse. What the Fed did at that point in time was to do everything it could to save the banking system. I don't blame the Fed for doing that. I probably would have done the same if I were running the Fed, but we shouldn't have been at that point in time. Nonetheless, what the Fed did was at the expense of trying to stabilize the domestic economy. We're still in a circumstance where the Fed hasn't worked a way out of its problems of 2008. So it's that, well, of that is stagnant, and then you've had the Congress moving off in its regular varied directions without any great focus of addressing the long-range solvency issues, which are absolutely primary. So we're now down to a point that we're about to get a new tax law, or at least a lot of talk that there's a new tax law that's going to be passed. This should be part of a package aimed at stimulating the economy, and it should be part of a package of bringing the the federal budget deficit under control. I mean, I don't normally get into things that should be done here, but let me just round that out, because the crisis here is the long-term solvency of the government. That creates all sorts of issues. People who think that the economy is just booming along now, I can assure you it's not. A lot of games being played with the numbers. The economy needs stimulus, but you can't stimulate it without widening the budget deficit. And you widen the budget deficit, that's going to rattle the foreign exchange markets. You see weakness in the dollar, headline selling against the dollar, which creates all sorts of problems with other markets like the stock market. So what's needed is a comprehensive package. You have the president come forward and talk with the American people, and we've got to fix it if we want to have long-term solvency and health of the economy, financial health for our families and children, so that what they have to do is come up with, number one, a long-term package to bring U.S. solvency under control. It can be done. That a lot of the long-term issues are tied to the programs such as Social Security and Medicare, very sensitive areas, but I've always seen the U.S. Public willing to sacrifice for the general good if you have a real crisis in hand, and we have a real crisis in hand. If you can come forward with a package that gives you long-term solvency of the federal government, that will then give you the support of the currency markets. All the dollar problems, you know, recent years have been tied to the long-term solvency issues generally, and that's the big scare in the currency markets. So that if you can address that long-term solvency issue, then you have the ability to maybe take the current deficit into a wider territory in an effort to stimulate the economy, get the economy growing again, generating more positive tax revenues. And then within this grand scheme of bringing the system into balance, and with the foreign markets buying into that and willing to support the dollar and hold treasury bonds under those circumstances, you may have a workable circumstance, but it's one that's got to be presented and sold to the American people, sold to the global markets, and we're not seeing anything like that happening. I'm looking for something like that to happen, and then I look at this tax package, which we're seeing, and there's some positive things in it, but it doesn't do much to, it's not part of a grand scale package to bring things into balance, which would be nice. And what you're seeing here is effectively outright fraud by the federal government that's been in the works for a long time. I take offense at it. Back in, back since the early 1980s, federal government has moved to change the way it calculates inflation. It's changed methodology over time. It did that in the 1980s with what they called hedonic quality adjustments. The computers generated estimates of quality improvements that were technological and couldn't be measured directly. And the effect was that it tended to lower quality changes were improvements which lowered the inflation rate. It's one reason that people don't see inflation as being realistically reported by the government. But into the 1990s, there was some very overt actions taken by the federal government to change the headline reporting of the CPI. And that was tied to basically the measuring a constant standard of living. We've talked about this before, but the way inflation used to be, at least the way it used to be measured, was you measured what you needed to maintain a constant standard of living. You know, if you buy these particular goods each year and they go up in price by 5%, then that's how much you need to increase your earnings by in order to stay even with inflation. But there was an effort made in the mid-90s with Alan Greenspan and the Boskin Commission to recast inflation to put it on a substitution basis, so that if the price of steak went up, they'd adjust for something like people buying more hamburger or chicken to compensate for the more expensiveness of the steak. And that's what they've moved to with what is now being published as the chain consumer price index. That came out of all these discussions in the 1990s, as well as changes to the reporting of the CPI inflation, which generally have understated it. And the reason that the government did that, and the way it was expressed in the 1990s, was that this is a way that the government could bring its deficit under better control, effectively by having a better quality CPI. Well, that better quality is just from the government standpoint. From the average person's standpoint, you want to know what your cost of living is, how much you need to make in order to keep living as you're living. You don't want to have to buy chicken because a steak gets too expensive. You want your income to increase. You need to know that you have to adjust things in order to maintain that standard of living. Or if you can't, at least it's nice to know how much you're falling short. But these changes were made. And what they invented was the chain-weighted CPI. Now, it's 7/10 of a percentage point less than the headline CPI, which has been reduced otherwise by redefinitions over the last decade or two. But the chain-weighted CPI is now tied to this new tax package. The whole intent of this new CPI was to help reduce the budget deficit. How does it do that? Well, two ways. One, you're seeing artificially low inflation, which is going to be used eventually in the cost of living adjustments for Social Security. We're seeing that already in the headline CPI, which was redefined, and they didn't have to go through any great legislative feat to get that in place. They've just done that quietly. But the other factor is, to the extent they can lower inflation, it boosts people into higher tax brackets artificially. So that what they're looking for with this new package is that it will, over the next a decade or two, will add what will increase tax revenues by literally hundreds of billions of dollars. People paying the taxes because they're in higher tax brackets, because they've been boosted by an inflation rate that is much too low, but they've been boosted into those tax brackets. And people, they haven't done this fully yet, but you know it's coming to the cost of living adjustments for Social Security, is that they're going to be putting this chain-weighted CPI in there now that it's being formalized. And that'll reduce the level of the cost of living adjustments. These are all gimmicks by the government, but my contention is effectively it's a tax on the public. They're not being honest with the public. Lowering the payments to people on Social Security may seem like an easy gimmick to them, but it's effectively a tax on the people who would otherwise be receiving more in cost of living adjustments. Certainly is a tax on people who are being boosted into higher tax brackets, where it's all a gimmick with these numbers. As far as I'm concerned, the government should just be straightforward and say, hey, look, this is what we're doing. You have a tax bracket at this. Okay, you want to have this kind of adjustment here. We've got to make other changes in Social Security, or we've got to raise taxes. Make it a legitimate tax. That's the way the system was designed to work. Don't do it by subterfuge and make people feel badly because they can't make ends meet. That's what's happening. I'll contend that the U.S. economy is not recovering, despite some very unusual headline numbers we've seen that have been massively distorted by the hurricane effects of recent months. You're seeing that beginning to turn around in the next month or two of reporting. You should see the economic numbers settle back down into weaker ranges, and you know, concerns again about the economy falling off, and even with the new Fed chairman coming in, who seems to be very much in line with Janet Yellen's thinking, the Fed there is going to be faced with issues as to what it does with a weakening economy, and I don't think they're going to tighten much. In fact, we'll probably move back towards an expanded quantitative easing as the economy slows down more. All of that's bad for the dollar, which generally would be very bad for the stock market. Stock market has a lot of support right now from what has been a relatively strong dollar, given there to a certain extent by the Fed. But if the dollar's under heavy selling pressure, foreign investors are going to want out of the U.S. markets, as will some people in the U.S. markets. That would tend to be a very bad circumstance for stocks. Flight from the dollar will also tend to be inflationary, and all that tends to be good for gold. So looking over the longer haul, and that's all I'm looking at. I'm not into looking at day-to-day volatility other than when there's some particularly unusual circumstances. What I look at here is a long-term circumstance. Generally, I see debasement in the dollar, higher inflation down the road, which means where the stock market will tend to stay ahead of inflation. It doesn't always with a heavy inflation. You could have and particular weakness in the dollar. You can have some flight from the stock market. I'm looking long term at holding physical gold and silver, the precious metals. Long term, they're your best bet for preserving the purchasing power of your wealth and assets. So my outlook there hasn't changed a bit.
You do like the precious metals then as an insurance policy. Fed funds futures contract indicates December rate hike, quarter point rate hike, almost a sure thing here, over 91%. What are the implications for the economy and the markets?
My betting is you're not going to see if that comes into play. And we'll see what happens in the next, effectively here the next month. Let's see what happens with the next couple of weeks. Economic reporting, I think you're going to see some downside surprises there, and maybe the expectations there will back off. But even if they don't, they raise it. They're faced with the same problem. They don't have a solid economy, and they're going to have to move to back off as the economy weakens, and you see increased liquidity pressures on the banking system. The banking system isn't as healthy as people like to think. A lot of problems continuing there. And that's the Fed's primary concern.
Do you believe that the rate hike cycle may be coming to a close?
It's been a real funny rate hike cycle because most of the rate hikes have been imaginary and talk. It's gone up some, but mostly jawboning to support the dollar. People are expecting it. We're getting real close. Just see what happens with those economic statistics. You're going to be seeing some downturn a couple of months, and as that settles in and the sentiment shifts back against all these crazy numbers we've been seeing out of the employment numbers that were so heavily skewed out of the hurricane. As the sentiment on the economy shifts, so too will the expectations.
Do you expect our ECB, BOJ, People's Bank of China, will they continue with their monetary expansion?
They'll generally be following the U.S. lead here, which will be more loosening or remaining loose. No, but nobody's got a resolution yet to the post-banking system crisis. I just don't see this having a happy ending. Eventually, you see debasement of the currencies and inflation, and that's where physical gold becomes your ultimate hedge, not only in the United States, but in the rest of the world. But I'm looking specifically at the United States here.
You know, anything you see on the horizon that might impact investors' decision-making?
With all this nonsense we've been seeing in terms of Congress fighting with the president in terms of coming up with a cohesive policy, that's the type of thing that maybe will be brought together by some kind of a financial crisis. And if you have a massive sell-off in stocks, which wouldn't surprise me, I mean, it's not a stable circumstance, that might do it. Things are not going to stay as they are for very long here. I can't give you a specific time frame, but I'd expect by early in the new year you'll be seeing some major shifts in the market's economic outlook. And with that, I'd expect you'd see some shifts in the direction of the dollar, some heavy dollar selling, and also some shifts in the other financial markets. A lot of it tied to how the economy looks. And if you have a crisis in there with a stock crash or something like that, that could be a trigger for, I mean, as terrible as such a thing would be, it also could be a trigger for a lot of good that might bring the system into long-term stability, or at least efforts to bring the system into long-term stability. It's not in long-term stability now. The Goldilocks scenario has been the Federal Reserve, and they've been trying to keep the system from collapsing, and along with that goes a lot of publicity and public opinion manipulation, all sorts of games playing. It's not a happy circumstance. It's not a stable circumstance. There's no way the current circumstance just works it out in itself into living happily ever after. We've got some difficult decisions and actions that have to be taken in the not too distant future to bring things into long-term stability. And the more delayed the circumstances are in terms of trying to bring things into long-term stability, the more difficult and painful it will be to do so.
When this reset you seem to be alluding to comes to pass, what emerges as the go-to asset class?
Keep holding gold until you actually get there, or you're convinced it's going to happen. Even then, gold is a long-term best bet, because there's always going to be inflation.
All right, John Williams, Shadow Stats, must read information. I encourage everyone to pick up a copy. Bookmark this website.
The website, shadowstats.com. Current headlines in terms of the commentary that goes out. I put out at least a weekly commentary electronically, and there's a lot of material on the site that gives you background in terms of the long-range outlook and inflation, employment. I put out alternate measures on unemployment and inflation with explanations as to what the government has done over time to generate more positive numbers, which the public is hit with all the time.
Yeah, that's an interesting way of putting it, which really, you know, erodes the integrity and transparency of almost any type of analysis. All right, John Williams, always a pleasure. Look forward to hearing your thoughts again in 2018.
Okay, Chris, thank you very much.
With stocks hitting new highs, the next sector to fly could be the precious metals. GoldSeek's top industry analyst just uncovered another solid gold opportunity, Silvercorp Metals. Silvercorp's key property is located in China, the largest gold producer in the world. Silvercorp's net income is soaring, up 589%. Production eclipsed guidance by 27.5%, totaling 6.5 million ounces. Mining operations are literally printing silver at only $3.82 per ounce. AISC net byproducts credits for the fiscal year 2017. Sales increased 51% year over year, and cash flow from operations more than doubled to $80 million. Silvercorp continues to set the industry standard with reduced costs, equity appreciation, a solid dividend, and improved free cash flow. Silvercorp is uniquely positioned to capitalize on rising silver, lead, and zinc prices. To learn more about the exceptional opportunity in Silvercorp Inc., direct your web browser to silvercorpmetals.com, ticker symbol SVM in the U.S. and Canada. Remember to treat your portfolio with a core position in Silvercorp Metals.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Nevelier runs Nevelier & Associates, also editor of four leading stock advisory newsletters. Welcome back, Louis Nevelier.
Good to be here.
Great to have you back. Are you all in Reno today or South Florida?
I'm in Reno.
All right. Well, we wanted to start off with, the top stories, obviously, on the market.
It is a pause that refreshes. Some of it's also because the FANG stocks had a kind of burp, for lack of a better word. But at the end of any earnings season, stocks like to consolidate, and that's all that's happening. But I'm very comfortable and confident that as we approach Thanksgiving, everything will firm up and we'll have our traditional early January effect where the market broadens out and we have a seasonal surge. Around the holidays, we gather for friends, family, football, food. It's a happy time of year. It seems to rub off on the stock market. So I expect a nice year-end rally and another early January effect, and I expect a good start.
You know, this rally since 2009, so many folks sold out at the bottom and just didn't participate in much of the rally. It seems like every new peak and every little pause, we hear from the same group of naysayers calling a top. Usually, everybody's bullish at a top. It seems like everybody's bearish here.
Yeah, they are. We had some divergences, though, institutional investors and retail investors. I got a report from Bespoke that showed some divergence. I think the biggest issue is that everybody wants a correction, but it's hard to correct when the dividend yields are so high. It's also hard to correct when the earnings are so good. We were all expecting a dramatic deceleration in earnings in the third quarter. Just to take a step back, first quarter earnings were the best in 5 years. Second quarter earnings were the best in 6 years, and we thought the S&P earnings would slow down at about a 4% pace in the third quarter, and they're running well over 8%. They're double what we expected. And now the fourth quarter earnings are going to be even better because the economy's taken off again. We do have 3% GDP growth now. It's in sight with strong business spending, strong consumer spending, productivity, higher exports, more narrow trade deficit. Looks like the Fed's going to have their last rate increase in December. The new Fed chairman's going to be trying to get the velocity of money up. That's how fast money changes hands. So prosperity continues to spread and rise. And it's a worldwide global event, too. So, fascinating environment we're in, but it's I expect more melt up.
Okay, well, let's talk about some of the latest Navalier upgrades, if you will. Upgraded from hold to buy. Aflac, AFL, BHP, BP, the gas company or petroleum, and Celgene.
Well, let's start with Celgene because the biotechs are having a bit of an issue, okay? I like the ones that have the earnings, but I don't have any biotechs that have hit my radar. British Petroleum did hit my radar the other day, okay? But it wasn't strong enough for me to buy it fundamentally, although it's certainly a good stock to go bargain hunting in. Our firm runs a PEG portfolio now, price earnings growth ratio portfolio, and things like BP are showing up. Aflac, it's okay. Not strong enough for me.
BHP Billiton Limited.
Yeah, it's too volatile for me right now. I don't really have many energy right now. I have a couple terminal companies, but, you know, energy's up because of the chaos in Saudi Arabia.
The uptrend or the breakout in petroleum, you think it's a little late to get on board that?
I think time of year where demand drops. Demand's going to go up in the spring. In fact, I'm headed to Malta because there's a lot of money sloshing around the world right now. Money's on the move. Because they have to turn over about $800 billion, apparently, to the government over there. So what's happening is that this is a temporary event, and in the end, supply and demand rules the roost. I don't like to jump in just because of what's happening in Saudi Arabia right now.
And moving on to Prudential, ticker PUK, Phillips 66, PSX, Vodafone, VOD.
To me, Phillips 66 is fine. That shows up in our dividend graders and everything. Prudential's okay. It's a foreign stock. That's going to be more dependent upon the yield curve. It's flattened out here, so I'd like to avoid that. Vodafone's an interesting company. They're extremely dominant in Europe. I'm a little worried about them, so they're not on my radar at this moment.
Any thoughts on Twitter? Sort of a turnaround candidate. This is just from a sell to a hold. Ticker TWTR.
I love the Chinese Twitter called Webco. There's been the president of China did a corruption crackdown, basically eliminated all his opponents, just made himself president for life. Twitter over here in America is a little different. If we want to know what the president's saying. So Webco over in China is so the people can gossip about what's happening, and here we just use it to see what President Trump's saying and some other people. Twitter doesn't hit my criteria now because the earnings aren't.
Any positive comments on either the XAU gold shares or bullion?
There was all these ugly rumors that the Saudis are dumping their gold, that Bitcoin is competing with gold. I think I don't see the traditional people that have physical bullion running to Bitcoin. I think there's a lot of fake news out there. There's a lot of static. And I think, you know, gold's a fine allocation. And whether it's 4, 6, 8%, I'll leave that up to folks and their advisor. We prefer physical gold versus the actual, gold bullion stocks or GLD, the ETF. You know, it's just there when the world ends. I think, you know, next time there's a crisis, gold will go nuts. Right now there's confidence in central banks, so gold's been a little more quiet.
Couple of ratings boosts here. BMY, Bristol Myers Squibb, and there's also Alexion Pharmaceuticals, a little less well known. ADI Analog Devices. Any of those interesting?
Bristol Myers is okay for dividends. We have some positive analyst upgrades.
Do you have any comments on the general forecast projections on U.S. shares? We're looking for at least 24,000 Dow and then a consolidation.
Estimating 11% earnings growth next year, I think that's very realistic. Typically, the analysts are optimistic in the beginning of the year. They get more pessimistic as the year goes on. But we do have this nirvana environment where businesses are confident, consumers are confident, don't have a lot of inflation brewing. The new Fed guy, Jerome Powell, was really at the urging of Steven Mnuchin here. He really wanted Powell in as the Fed guy. And I just think he wants them to stop their infighting, you know, infighting on the Fed. They've been fighting a mythical inflation beast that has not materialized. I think we want to have a little bit more pro-market, pro-business Fed. That's welcome, and hopefully under Powell they'll be a little stricter. But, you know, this is as good as it gets, and we've had a stunning year. Stocks are not going up as much as earnings are going up, and earnings are still forecast to steadily rise next year. So I think it's great. The only thing is it's getting a little more narrow. Markets always get more narrow as we go higher.
Do you see any other asset classes you find appealing at these levels?
Well, it's mostly the tech stocks, and it's mostly the Chinese stocks that are being added to the Morgan Stanley indices. There's another trick up my sleeve. We just wrote a little white paper about the Robo Rebellion. They're letting the robots run our money now on Wall Street, and we're very worried they'll cause another crash or crisis because ETFs do not trade at net asset value. They trade at premiums or discounts. And we're worried that the possibility that they might all try to sell at the same time and create the market. I'm not sure the robots have been programmed to measure the premium discount. Back in 2015, we had a 90-minute period where there was a 35% discount intraday on like big dividend ETFs, DVY, and iShares dividend ETFs. So we want to make sure that we don't have any more trading glitches. Our biggest fear are glitches, mechanical things on Wall Street, so much a prolonged crash. We do have a cheerleader in the White House for the stock market. Obviously, President Trump wants to remind us how much wealth he's creating all the time. I guess he thinks that's good for him.
You talk about the flash crash 2015, 30-35% retracement. Think of the arbitrage opportunities. If you had lowball orders in through options.
You could have had open orders, or you could have just been watching and placed orders out there. But a lot of that was caused by my neighbors here in South Florida. See, down here in Florida, people retire and they miscalculate. They miscalculate for their property taxes and other things. So we had folks borrowing on, taking out home equity loans to buy more dividend stocks, especially MLPs, some high-yielding ones. And there were serious margin calls on August 24th of 2015. So some of this, some of that correction was triggered by seniors being leveraged up to here in South Florida. So we wrote a white paper explaining that it was actually the title of the white paper is the government caused the financial crisis in 2008. We're talking about how credit default swaps imploded and how there were investments leveraged 10 to 1, 8 to 1 that all imploded. Threw a lot of politicians under the bus in both parties. But then we want to say, okay, well, here's what happens when margin comes back. And we cited August 24th of 2015. We just wrote a new white paper warning about the Robo Rebellion, we had another little glitch after Brexit where a lot of ETFs were trading, yield-oriented ETFs were trading up to 4% premium, and other ETFs were trading at deep discount. Well, Betterment, the biggest robo program out there, actually stopped trading that day, which was great because that was the right thing to do. But we're not confident that all the robots will stop trading, and we're scared that some will start to trade and create the market. And we predicted up to a 70% intraday correction if it goes on for a few days. So it's a real problem. Again, people don't know that ETFs don't trade at net asset value, but on an up day, they're trading at a premium. On a down day, they're trading at a discount. I happen to know that. We're top-ranked in ETF management. It's pretty funny. Although we're top 1% in ETF management in the past three years, and we've got 4 or 5-star ETF portfolios, our stock stuff is so much better than our ETF stuff because we know what the ETFs are adding every 90 days. So at the end of each quarter, we take a lot of the smart beta ETFs. We know what they're going to be buying. We just buy ahead on our stock stuff.
Oh, you front-run the ETFs. Of course, you don't know with absolute assurance, but you have a very good guess on what they'll be adding to their portfolios. You did mention leverage and, of course, real estate. A lot of talk about credit default swap volume increasing similar to 2006, 2007. People worried about this echo bubble in housing. However, if you look at new housing starts, that's my favorite leading indicator on the sector. Nothing wrong there. Nice, steady 45-degree improvement month after month, year after year.
Every housing market has a line. Above the line, it gets soft. Below the line, it gets weak, but the lines are moving up and encompassing more and more homes. Obviously, they're trying to change the tax bill, so your home's not going to be a big itemized deduction. So it might hurt some of the really super luxury properties, but that's not what drives the housing market in the United States. Very, very comfortable and confident that the housing market's healthy, the stock market's healthy. They're the biggest beneficiaries of the current low interest rate environment we're in. The yield curve is as flat as it's been in 10 years, and as that yield curve flattens out, the Fed cannot raise rates further. So the Fed will probably raise rates in December and be one and done, and that's it. And then the new Fed chairman will be more pro-business.
Fed funds futures currently indicate over about a 91% odds of a rate hike. So that's pretty much baked into the cake, I guess, at this point. And you seem to think that would be it. Tell about Navalier Associates and any services that you provide, contact information.
We have a management company called Navalier Associates. It's headquartered in Reno, Nevada. I guess we're most famous for a fund that we run. We were number one fund in the third quarter. It was at 14.54. It's the Cavalier Fundamental Growth Fund. We're a sub-advisor to it. We're known for great risk-adjusted performance. We're a low-beta growth manager, so we try to get you smooth, steady returns. So if you go to our website, click on the risk-adjusted view of some of our portfolios, and you see we have the lowest beta, lowest max drawdown, lowest standard deviation of many of our peers. But we have very good absolute performance as well. We also publish newsletters on NavalierGrowth.com. We have to keep those businesses separate. Both the management company, Navalier.com, and the newsletter site, NavalierGrowth.com, have free databases for grading your stocks and dividends, your dividend stocks and your growth stocks. They're separate databases, but you can key in all your stocks and grade them. They're updated every week automatically. We're trying to empower investors. We also have free services like a free market mail on Navalier.com. It's my weekly market commentary of myself and four other folks that write for us. Very extensive. It's 20 pages every week, very detailed. So we don't want people to be alone out there. We want to keep everybody appraised.
Thank you so much.
Great talk to you. Take care.
With stocks hitting new highs, the next sector to fly could be the precious metals. GoldSeek's top industry analyst just uncovered another solid gold opportunity, Silvercorp Metals. Silvercorp's key property is located in China, the largest gold producer in the world. Silvercorp's net income is soaring, up 589%. Production eclipsed guidance by 27.5%, totaling 6.5 million ounces. Mining operations are literally printing silver at only $3.82 per ounce. AISC net byproducts credits for the fiscal year 2017. Sales increased 51% year over year, and cash flow from operations more than doubled to $80 million. Silvercorp continues to set the industry standard with reduced costs, equity appreciation, a solid dividend, and improved free cash flow. Silvercorp is uniquely positioned to capitalize on rising silver, lead, and zinc prices. To learn more about the exceptional opportunity in Silvercorp Inc., direct your web browser to silvercorpmetals.com, ticker symbol SVM in the U.S. and Canada. Remember to treat your portfolio with a core position in Silvercorp Metals.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Bix Weir, analyst and researcher, has some great material for our silver aficionados. Welcome on your debut appearance here on GoldSeek, Bix Weir.
Hey, thank you very much for having me.
Before we get into anything else, let's talk silver. I think I mentioned before the discussion that you make some astounding claims regarding, I think, the prospects 4AG. My listeners have had their eardrums worn out on the reasons behind why we need silver in every portfolio, everything from the astounding industrial applications that detractors try to use as a reason not to own silver. And so you've got some great material as to why even three-digit silver may be a low-ball estimate.
My interest in silver goes back 17, 18 years with GATA in the early days, and you know, we knew people were rigging the markets. We didn't know how. We didn't know exactly who it was, and we thought it was the banks. And you know, mainly it was gold back then. But you know, once you learn about the silver story and what's going on behind the scenes and how little there is left, you quickly make the realization that silver is a much better metal to own as far as potential for appreciation when the manipulation ends. I worked with GATA for 10 years, you know, with Bill Murphy and Chris Powell, trying to track down who's doing this market rigging, who's doing the price suppression. And I kind of split off in about 2008, 2009, because I think I discovered who was doing it and why they were doing it. And it's all done with computers and derivatives. As we know, the amount of derivatives that are traded vastly exceed the amount of physical metal out there. So my work in the last 7-8 years has been tracking down, you know, who writes these programs to rig the markets, how rigged are they, what kind of volumes are we talking about such that they can slam the price of silver from $50 down to $20 with a click of a mouse. And that's kind of where this strange trip led me, and it led me right to the halls of the Federal Reserve and the U.S. Treasury. So we go from there. They have full control right now, and I do believe that they will let go of that control at some point. And that's when you want to be in physical silver, holding it in your hands and ready to ride that price to the moon.
Exactly. This is what I wanted to get into today. I want this to be the focus, the crux, at least, of the first part of this discussion. Your seminal research into the computer algorithms and programming behind the scenes that allows, let's just say allegedly, because from what I've read and what I've heard in previous interviews, this is really groundbreaking stuff.
Well, it is, and it goes back to the early days of computers back in the 60s and 70s when, you know, computers were just being really invented. And the first shareable computer program was a program called BASIC. And BASIC, I don't know if you remember it, but it was written by a guy named...
I cut my teeth on BASIC.
Yeah, if you took any computer classes in the beginning, you had BASIC, you had Fortran. But the very early days, it was BASIC because it was the first shareable computer programming language. Now, the guy who invented BASIC was a guy named John Kimony. And John Kimony, really brilliant man, basically invented the ability for individuals to program and use computers back in the 1960s. But his best friend was a guy named Alan Greenspan. And Alan Greenspan, as we know, used to be a huge gold bug. I mean, he wrote the paper Golden Economic Freedom, and he was a gigantic gold bug, but most people didn't know that he was a computer expert in the 1960s. Writing programs using John Kimony's BASIC computer language, Alan Greenspan was the first guy to invent the banking programs that we use today. You know, today we look around, it's like everything is electronic money. There's very little physical money and very little gold and silver. It's all electronic. But Alan Greenspan was the guy who wrote the very first programs, and he was working with Arthur Burns, who was his mentor. He was the head of the Fed at the time. But Alan Greenspan actually blamed himself for the Y2K problem because he was the guy who programmed only two digits instead of four. So it really goes back to the very early days of computers and how the Federal Reserve Bank and Alan Greenspan and a couple other people within that close circle invented these computer programs to rig the markets in order to go off a gold standard. Because normally when you go off a gold standard, you've got, you know, 8 to 10 years before it all falls apart. Unless you rig the prices of everything from gold to silver to oil to all commodities to the stock market. And you can do that if you have control of computer programs. And the reason I found all this out was documentation that came out of the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston. Talks about this. It's a comic book that talks about this character, Ruta. Root A, which is a term in the very early days of BASIC computing. It is the root foundation of our monetary system, of the programs behind the scenes that run on the monetary system. So all that came out, and then there's so many items that I would connect and link, and you can see it today with the volumes that are traded of silver on the COMEX. I know a lot of people say, oh, it's traded 100 to 1. It's so fraudulent because, you know, 100 times the electronic metal is trading versus the physical metal. That number is very wrong. It's not 100 to 1. It's over 2,000 to 1, and that's just on the COMEX. So people need to get their head around the idea that the price of silver can be manipulated and suppressed with a click of a mouse from the basement of the Fed or the Treasury. That's where they have their trading rooms. So really interesting stuff, a lot of backup documentation and information and things coming out that are really confirming what I've long suspected, which is there is a plan to control the system via computers by controlling gold and silver prices, and there is a plan to destroy the mechanism that controls it by printing so much money that people won't accept it anymore. And that's kind of where we are with the United States.
Who'd have thought that Sir Dr. Alan Greenspan is Mr. Robot, is Elliot? It's better than science fiction. Major hat tip for, I think, being the first to uncover this and make it public in a very easy to understand way. Can you give us a quick synopsis, 3 bullet points from your excellent article that we've already published, we're going to publish again and keep disseminating it, but 3 of Bix Weir's favorite bullets for why silver is a 3-digit plus metal and how it's going to get there?
The first one is, and the most important, if this manipulation ends, which I think it will at some point, it's going to come down to who has physical in their own possession, physical silver in your own possession, not held anywhere else. And that's where the key is. The silver to gold ratio is artificial. It is not the price ratio right now at 70 to 1 or something like that is ridiculous because the availability of physical gold and physical silver is right around 6 billion ounces each, which is a 1 to 1 ratio. And gold is great. I love gold, but there's a lot more gold than they're telling you out there. And you don't really need gold for anything other than storing it for monetary reasons and jewelry, maybe. Silver is a completely the opposite story. You need silver for monetary purposes. It's the most used monetary metal in the history of monetary metals. But the key is technology has changed. Technology consumes silver. It doesn't save silver like gold is saved in a vault. Technology consumes silver. So most of the silver that has ever been mined in the world, which is 50 to 60 billion ounces, is now in landfills, is on the top of roofs and in solar panels, is exploded smart bombs. It is scattered in little tiny pieces all around the world. So that 50 to 60 billion ounces that was available potentially maybe 50, 60 years ago, now is all gone because it's been distributed in little tiny bits in landfills in your cell phone, in your flat screen TVs. So the difference between the price ratio of gold and silver versus the amount of available physical of each is night and day. And that's why the biggest reason I think at some point in the future when the silver rigging stops in the electronic markets, I believe that silver and gold will cross 1-to-1 ratio, which is a gigantic move, obviously, from where it is today.
For our high school econ majors, you know, or college econ majors, an inelastic demand curve. It just basically means that we need so much silver. Okay, it's so integral to our manufacturing and production. You mentioned solar panels and photovoltaics. Nevertheless, we have tons of the stuff just in soldering. It disappears forever. The soldering in your laptop, your cell phone, in the walls, in the doors. Oh, how about just light switches? It's gone forever. It disappears, and it's an incredibly useful substance, the most malleable, the most reflective, arguably the most electrically conductive, antimicrobial, it's an antibacterial, probably even antiviral. Let's look at the drachma in Greece. I think there's a 600-700 year period of stability where the only real money in circulation, for the most part, was a silver coin. Fast forward to the United States, 100 years of economic dominance and stability. And what did we have in circulation by law? You know, drum roll, please. Up until recently, but the bad money has driven out the good. Thank you, Mr. Grisham. So here we are today, Bix. Where does this all lead?
Well, I think we're coming close to that point where we're running out of silver. And the reason I think this is something that happened in 2016, and not many people have commented on this, but we all know the COMEX and the LBMA, they don't trade real metal for the most part. Mostly it's futures and options contracts. It's all futures and options on the COMEX. The COMEX volume for silver went up 45% in 2016. This is an unbelievable number, but in electronic contracts, they were trading an average per day of 400 million silver ounces. The need to rig the markets and control the price of silver is getting harder and harder for these people. And if you look at, if you take the average daily volume of silver traded on the COMEX and you expand it out to say how much silver was traded on the COMEX in 2016, it's over 100 million ounces or 100 billion ounces of silver, which is ridiculous, as we all know, because there's only been 50 to 60 billion ounces ever mined. So it's getting harder and harder to rig the silver market. Gold is just the same. Gold's up 51%. The amount of derivative trades versus how much physical silver is out there. To control the price, they need to layer more and more derivative trades on top of it, and that's how the prices are getting rigged. And we had a great confession from Deutsche Bank, and they turned in all their friends of market riggers, and the CFTC hasn't done anything about it. There's a lot of news to come out about that in the coming months and years, because this is an admission of what GATA has been saying for years, that the bullion banks rig the gold and silver markets. This is an admission in court, and there's a list of banks, and all those banks that are on the list of those who got turned in are on the LBMA. There's five members, clearing members, and they're all on that list. So, yes, GATA was correct all along. The silver price is rigged. The gold price is rigged. And you need to get in before the rigging goes away.
All right, Bixware, what about the skeptic in the audience saying, what's this I hear about silver shortages? Isn't silver a major byproduct of nickel and particularly copper production?
Well, I say that's a great example of what, you know, we're going to need going forward. I mean, how much silver, physical silver, is really out there? Nobody really knows. According to the LBMA, they claim to trade over 129 billion ounces of physical silver every year. Again, another report that's completely ridiculous. The fact that the amount of silver mined and available is going to grow is true. And the same is true for the amount of uses we will find for silver. Silver is still the best conductor of electricity. We are living in a technological age, and those inventions and technologies that Donald Trump talked about in his inauguration speech are coming true, and they will stop holding back the ability for people to create and innovate new electronic forms of energy, forms of communication going forward. Really exciting for silver, and I'm glad that there's more silver. Bring it on. Bring on as much silver as you can, because they're printing up way too many dollars, and what we need to do is get rid of the electronic fake silver that's traded on the COMEX and the LBMA.
I'd like your thoughts on what happened recently during our presidential election. I think, in fact, it may have been the actual day. In India, I'm bringing this up to all of our guests in the past couple of weeks, and price spike up to over $3,600 a moonshot on the yellow metal, on news that they would be returning to a more digital currency. Folks might say, well, it's India, it's contained. But I worry if it's not really the canary in the proverbial mine shaft. What happens when people en masse really wake up to the idea there's something wrong here with our greenback?
You got to remember that price is determined on the COMEX and the LBMA, and for gold, they have on the COMEX, 27, 28 million ounces of electronic gold trade every day on the COMEX. So these numbers are not real that you see, the $1,300 or $1,200 or the $18 for silver. These are not real numbers. These are electronic computers trading back and forth. The majority of these trades are the bullion banks working for the U.S. Treasury and U.S. Fed? The whole concept of, oh, it spiked, the price spiked because of something else is kind of irrelevant because it really doesn't matter. They control it with a computer. They can change the price from $1,300 to $13,000 to probably $100 with a click of a mouse because it's unlimited the amount of sell orders that they can put in if you're the U.S. government and the Fed. Because you don't have the CFTC watching you, obviously, because you know they haven't come down on the silver or gold manipulators. So, yes, there are a lot of signs. You can give me a million different signs why silver and gold should spike. But the question is, how high should it spike, and how high will it spike without the manipulators and their, you know, trading electronic contracts back and forth? That's the real exciting thing. Everything else, we've been arguing these points since, you know, the 90s, how gold should go up because they're printing so much money. And, you know, there's 50 million reasons. But ultimately, it comes down to who controls the price of gold and silver with what computer programs and when they're going to end that game.
Who controls the price of the precious metals and what are the implications, please?
Well, it's the Exchange Stabilization Fund. It's run out of the basement of the U.S. Treasury and at the Federal Reserve. The basement of the U.S. Treasury has a trading floor, computer trading floor. The Federal Reserve Bank of New York runs the operations from the New York, and then they've got the bullion banks and people like J.P. Morgan, who actually admitted in court in the lawsuit in 2003 that they were an agent of the U.S. government. It was a lawsuit by Blanchard and Company against J.P. Morgan and Barrick Gold. And in their memorandum asking the judge to throw out the case, J.P. Morgan said, we are an agent of the U.S. government. You can't sue us because we have sovereign immunity. That sums it up right there. That's why you don't see J.P. Morgan's name in all the lawsuits for silver manipulation that are coming out of the Deutsche Bank situation. So, yeah, it's all done out of the basement of the U.S. Treasury and U.S. Fed using the Exchange Stabilization Fund. Real interesting thing now, they put Steve Mnuchin, or trying to put Steve Mnuchin, as the head of the U.S. Treasury. He was the head of computer trading at Goldman Sachs. And that's a really scary deal. They tried to get Vincent Viola as head of the Navy. He was the head of Virtu Financial, which is a computer rigging company that is in charge of the SLV and GLD rigging operations behind the scenes. So, yeah, I don't know if Trump's going to continue the market rigging or stop the market rigging, but there's enough countries in the world that know exactly what the U.S. is doing that I think it's a good time for the U.S. to stop doing it because it's no longer beneficial. All the metals going east is no longer beneficial for us to rig the markets when China's, you know, cleaning our clock. So I think it's time to end this game and go back to free markets where you have people walking into exchanges with metal and with money, and the exchange happens, and then they walk away.
Then in this chaotic system, what will be the tipping point? What puts us over the edge?
It's going to be a click of a mouse, ultimately. That ends the rigging of gold and silver, which will end everything else. Because there's so many derivatives piled on to all these things I've talked about. And everybody talks about that, you know, hundreds of trillions of dollars in derivatives that almost imploded in 2008. Well, we're at that point again. The next time that someone like Hank Paulson goes into Congress and says, you know, we need $700 billion to bail out the banks or the whole world's going to end. The next time they're not going to bail out the banks. They can't. They're going to be going to Congress for $20 trillion instead of $700 billion. And the people have learned so much in the past 8-9 years that they're going to say, no, we're not going to allow this game to go on. And then we're going to have to start something new. And that's a whole other discussion. But there are plans for that at the Fed Boston and that I talk about in my Road to Ruta work. And it's real interesting. And I think we could come out of this pretty good. But a lot of people will lose a lot of virtual assets.
Obviously, our officials have carte blanche opportunity, deep pockets, or maybe they have the deepest of pockets. As you mentioned, they're in cahoots, if you will, with J.P. Morgan, and that's nothing new. I mean, go read about the actual J.P. Morgan himself, even the creation, as I understand it, of the Federal Reserve. This is nothing new. Obviously, there's going to be people listening to our voices who own StreetTracks SLV, you know, the silver ETF, and there are other paper promises out there. It seems as though you would be an advocate of physical precious metals.
Definitely. All our exchanges today, the stock markets, the COMEX, the LBMA, are all run on fractional reserve systems, and you can tell by the volumes traded. If you look at SLV and GLD, first of all, they allow shorting, which completely it takes away from the fact that you're supposed to be buying physical when you buy a share of SLV or GLD. By allowing shorting, people are buying thinking they own an ounce of physical silver when they don't because it's been shorted. That's one problem. Another problem is the amount of the volume traded on those exchanges, and all exchanges in stocks and bonds and currencies. They trade in huge rehypothecated fractional reserve system. So SLV, I don't know what the total float of SLV is right now, but it's usually 10 to 15 days everything trades because of these high-frequency traders. You know, they have trades going off at the milliseconds. And a lot of these trades are never settled. Settlement meaning the contracts are exchanged, the money is exchanged, and the share is changed into your name. That doesn't happen anymore. And the SEC has even said there's over 200 million shares not settled every single day on the stock market. The problem is when the music stops and these derivatives go off, you're going to have 10 to 15 people saying, oh, I own a share of SLV for every share there is out there. So it's a fractional reserve system. They all deal on net pools. All these brokerage houses deal on net pools. At the end of the day, they net out their buys and sells, or they're supposed to, and they still can't even do that. So very, very problematic. And then if you have the banking crash, you've got another problem because there are counterparty risks between you and your money because all these brokerage houses use the banks. If the banks go down, the brokerage houses go down.
It's reminiscent of MF Global, maybe mixed in with a little Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers.
Those were one-off instances that were able to be contained. It was difficult to contain them, but they were able to be contained. This is going to be everything at the same.
Systemic. And I know that folks are then wondering, what's next? I think you alluded to that. I mean, we've been speculating here for several months that you might see a cryptocurrency backed by either silver or gold or some other means. But, I mean, we've never had a totally global, interconnected, fiat-based system with very few exceptions.
I agree, except it's not just the global fiat currencies. Everything has been put onto an electronic disk and electronic storage. So people think they're assets. If you ask people in the early 1970s and you said, would you accept owning an electronic virtual asset over your current asset? They'd say, no way. Are you kidding me? An electronic blip would be used as an asset? Well, now everything is an electronic asset. And everything has been rehypothecated so many times in such a fractional reserve system. Nothing is going to survive this in the electronic form. Now, I think Bitcoin will because it is nobody's debt. The interesting thing about the electronic assets is they're all somebody's debt. They all rely on a third person to stay in business. Bitcoin doesn't. It is an electronic asset unto itself. As long as you don't hold it in a third-party storage place, you know, like on an exchange or in an online wallet, it's your asset. It's an underlying asset. Everything electronic else is usually people's debt and relies on a third party to stay in business. So it's so much bigger than the crashing of unbacked fiat money. This is a global buy-in to electronic assets being worth something when you try to cash them in. And there'd be so many defaults of the third parties that nobody's going to stay in business.
About half of America, 160, 170 million folks, half the households at least, have some exposure to equities, to U.S. stocks. And very few people understand the fact that these are just, I might say, illusory means of ownership. You really have a tough time even getting physical shares, the certificates, cut and sent to your home. What can you really do with them? You can't walk up to your neighbor and say, hey, you know, here's 10 shares of Google or 10 shares of Tesla or Netflix. It's really a game of musical chairs. And when the music stops, as you say, the whole system is infused with debt, and everything is debt-based. I mean, is that not the whole concept of the fractional reserve system? We're not going to know what hit us, are we, when this edifice finally implodes?
And that's what is talked about in the Fed Boston documents that I've, you know, analyzed and looked at for the last 10 years is, you know, how do we reallocate assets going forward is a big thing that they talk about. And Alan Greenspan actually came up with a great idea. After the system crashes, his idea was to reallocate assets according to Social Security balances, which is very unique because what it does, it kind of rewards the people who've made the most money and worked the hardest, but not, you know, extraordinarily, because, you know, they cap Social Security balances every year, how much they take out of your paycheck. So it kind of and it gets the older people who paid mostly into Social Security, they get most first, because you got to take care of the old people first. So it's a great idea, but even in the Fed Boston comics and in the teacher's guide to these comics and in the discussions they have about it, they say, we don't know if the people are going to accept something like this.
I'm a listener who bought silver in 2011 at the peak around $50, and I've been burned. I'm not happy about it. Convince me to hold it past 50, and where will it be? Where will it go?
Well, I plan on holding silver until the manipulation ends. So as far as where it would go, I don't really know. Most people don't know. The ratio between gold and silver is 70-1 currently, and the amount of physical available is probably 5-1, you know, 5 ounces of gold for every 1 ounce of physical silver, because all the gold is being saved and all the silver needs to be used. So you can draw your own conclusions. I give many big numbers when I do the analysis, because that's what comes out. Without manipulation, we're going to see somewhere, at least for a short time, somewhere around a 1-1 ratio, price of gold to the price of silver.
I have a bevy of additional questions. We'll have to save that for another chat. Bix Weir, please tell people more about Road to Root A, what they'll find, and why they need to bookmark that site.
RoadToRuta.com is my website. I have a YouTube channel, Road to Ruta. It has a video on there explaining what the Road to Ruta theory is, because it takes a little while to get used to it. Come on by, put your email in, and you'll get free emails on information that I look at every day.
Great stuff. Can't wait to have you back.
Great. Sounds good.
Rob Kirby, macroeconomic analyst formerly on the trading desk. He knows what's going on behind the scenes, and that's why we'd like to hear his thoughts. Welcome back, Rob Kirby.
Pleasure to be with you, Chris.
Great to have you. You know, we've had another good solid year. Silver up over 14%. XAU still on fire. Never really even hiccup. Give us an idea of what you see in the precious metals market.
What I see in the markets, Chris, is that both gold and silver are still not trading in what I would consider to be a free market. And much of our capital markets, in my view, represent little more than a massive crime scene. We see the long arm of government control in not only the precious metals arena, but we see it in various currency markets, and we see it very heavily in the bond market. And to put your listenership sort of in the picture in terms of a free versus a highly manipulated and distorted market, I would suggest people take a look at the way that Bitcoin currently trades, and you will have a pretty good idea, if you watch Bitcoin for a few days, the way a real freely traded market actually operates. The reason why Bitcoin is able to trade and operate somewhat as a free market is because Bitcoin has a unique quality that isn't present in gold or silver or bonds. Namely, you cannot sell a Bitcoin that you do not own, or that has not been mined. But what this does is it takes all this optionality out of the trade in Bitcoin. And when I say optionality, or the rude manipulation of the futures markets, we did see in the aftermath of the U.S. presidential election on election night, we saw the market's initial reaction to the unexpected Trump win. We saw that immediately gold went up close to $100, and the stock market futures plummeted on that same news. But, you know, late in the evening, the apparatus that controls the pricing of so much of our markets in the Western world came to work, and they reversed those superior gains in the precious metals, which intuitively was correct. The tremendous drop in the equity futures, which was intuitively correct. And these movements were reversed by force. In the case of gold, literally in paper form in the 72 hours following the presidential election, more than three times the globe's annual production of gold out of the Earth's crust was sold in paper form inside of 72 hours after the election. What this amounts to, Chris, it's gold that, A, does not exist, and technically it's gold that will never exist for sale. And it's through the selling of these paper products on futures markets or digital markets. A lot of people refer to this as paper gold, but this enables the price managers, which in my books is the U.S. Treasury, are able to keep the price of gold suppressed, meaning that the alternative to the precious metals, or sorry, to the dollar, being the precious metals. They want to keep their fiat money backed by nothing, looking superior to real money, which is precious metal.
Cryptocurrencies are something I've dabbled with personally, primarily a silver-backed cryptocurrency I call Silverbit, piggyback blockchain off of Ethereum. And any of my listeners who know, Ethereum is, I think, going to overtake the rest of the cryptocurrency space eventually. That's just my personal opinion. At least it has the opportunity. But back on point, they've sort of let the genie out of the bottle. And we talked about this in last week's show. I mean, Gresham's Law, bad money drives away the good money. Our authorities haven't really grasped yet, and maybe this is a topic for another show, there's a new bad money. Of course, we don't think of it as bad. We don't think of this revolution in bitcoins as being bad, but it really is a totally, in many ways, free money, unless we want to get down to the heavily energy and algorithm intensive. The Chinese are way ahead of us on this because they have access to virtually free energy, as I'm sure you know. I really wonder if the Fed and the Treasury and their economists have pondered and examined just where this is going to lead. The dollar's reserve currency status, I don't think it can survive, can it? A competing money.
I would respond to that by saying the rise in the popularity and the usage of cryptocurrencies, in my view, is the manifestation of the law of unintended consequences, because it's my belief that naturally in a freely traded market, gold and silver would have risen very, very dramatically and sufficiently that they would be currently expressing themselves as very, very meaningful, viable alternatives to fiat currency, which has been extremely mismanaged by the stewards of the world's reserve currency, the U.S. financial elites and the central banking community around the world, because the European Central Bank is doing a very poor job as well in managing the euro. My view that the rise of the cryptocurrencies has happened precisely because gold and silver has not been allowed to do and perform its historical function. And the rise of the cryptocurrencies is showing us, or is the manifestation of humanity's dislike and lack of trust in fiat money. People intuitively know when they're getting a bad deal. And you see, it's like water finds its level. If you try to put 2 gallons of water in a 1 gallon pail, the 1 gallon that cannot be contained in the pail finds a resting spot elsewhere. And the rise of the cryptocurrencies is effectively the faith which has been displaced from fiat currencies finding its place elsewhere. And this will continue to accelerate because the clowns running our global fiat money systems have no plans other than to continue to create more fiat money at increasingly swift rates.
But what officials have done by corralling the gold and silver markets in such fashion, using the most unbelievable paper schemes since, I think, arguably, the great revolutions in France, just hasn't been anything like this since John Law. You have an inevitable filling of the void, this brilliant algorithm we call Bitcoin. Is it possible that even Bitcoin will eventually have inherent limitations, many of which we already know and we've found, folks will turn back to that barbarous relic?
I believe so. But what I find fascinating about it all, Chris, is the sheer irony in what's occurred. Because what the managers of our fiat system have tried to pull on humanity by employing algorithms and futures and derivatives, they've attempted to limit the rise in the price of gold and silver using these algorithmic computer-assisted trading schemes, and it's going to be an algorithm that undoes them. So currencies are algorithms.
I think it's just as ironic, a Satoshi, the smallest denomination of a Bitcoin, we refer to as a Satoshi, which of course also the name of the creator. Is it possible that this was really little more than a CIA side project? I think someone would have stepped up and claimed responsibility at $1,000 a Bitcoin right now. I mean, keep in mind, just a few years ago, it was pennies on the dollar. From what I've read, Satoshi put aside, I think it's 500,000, and then the rest were placed in the blockchain. So I'd like your thoughts on whether or not this might just be a CIA operation or KGB, a parallel, you know, monetary system.
Well, I do believe that necessity is the mother of all creation, and it's been the poor stewardship of our global fiat monetary system. It's the manifestation of the failure of Keynesian economics that has given rise to the advent of these cryptocurrencies. Without a doubt, exactly who's created it, I don't claim. Look at the current system. I mean, we can examine. I mean, it was just last week there was a paper made public by a chap by the name of Grant Williams. And if you go to YouTube and you plug in the name Grant Williams and along with the words mines and money, you will see a presentation which was given late last year at a big conference. And I believe it was in Singapore at the Mines and Money Conference. It's an annual event. What he illustrates in a very, very, very short space of time in this YouTube video is how the world is de-dollarizing. In de-dollarizing, he illustrates how crude oil is being transacted in other than dollars between major parties in the world. And when other countries deal in crude oil, big enough countries deal in crude oil in sufficient amounts in non-dollars, the amount of dollars they need to hold in their reserves lessens over time. What we have seen empirically, and Grant Williams illustrates this in his YouTube video, countries like China and Saudi Arabia have actually begun to lessen their holdings of U.S. government securities. And they've been doing this at quite a rapid clip now over the past 18 months to 2 years. And the implications for this on a go-forward basis, when you take into consideration that China and Saudi Arabia are historically two of America's biggest financiers and creditors who buy up the American debt when it's issued, they are holding less today than they were 2 years ago. And what this means is, and people should be asking some very serious questions about what the implications of this are, if China and Saudi Arabia are buying less, who's picking up the slack? Because America continues to run massive deficits. So not only do we have problems consuming or allocating the outstanding debt, we're still piling on, I don't know, roughly at least $1 trillion a year to the outstanding. So who's buying the bonds, Chris? That's my question, and nobody seems to be able to give me an answer that I can stomach or believe. Who is buying the bonds?
This is a rhetorical question, I feel.
Yes, I have a theory on exactly who's buying the bonds. It's my belief that the Exchange Stabilization Fund in America is actually buying these bonds with dark dollars that aren't even admitted to exist.
The plunge protection team.
But it's my belief that debt is being bought by America in dollars that do exist, but they exist on the dark side of the U.S. Treasury's ledger. Because they are dollars that are purchasing this debt that's being liquidated by foreign holders, it cannot show up in the reserve accounts of any other entity. And as such, this debt moves to the dark side of the U.S. Treasury's ledger because that's where the dollars came from that were used to purchase it. We've heard stories, or at least I've heard stories, over the past number of months that the world is actually suffering from a condition of too few dollars. And anybody who actually believes that, in my view, given everything that we empirically know has occurred, the fact that countries are rebuking the dollar and are trying to liquidate their reserves or lessen them, to me, speaks absolutely against the notion that there are not enough dollars in the world.
I think it's just like anything else, you know, like a VCR. I mean, it's going to carve out its own spot and maybe eventually overtake the currency space, or maybe just move in parallel, as we still have movie theaters today. But think of it as a diversification tool and not as a substitute for the precious metals, because if the power goes out, if there's a major emergency and whatnot, good luck getting, you know, your local folks, maybe even neighbors, to accept even a private Bitcoin wallet that's separate from your hard drive. It's just not going to work. Whereas, you know, junk silver and small denominated gold coins will be your go-to asset in times of trouble. And I think it just always will be the case.
I was just going to say, Chris, I think you stated it very accurately. Fiat currencies, whether it be dollars, Reichsmarks, Zimbabwean dollars, or the fiat currencies run from, as I've heard it before, from A to Z, a currency that begins with the letter A. I guess you could say the American dollar, really, I guess, begins with A, to Z being Zloty, which is another failed fiat currencies. But fiat currencies come and go. Gold and silver endure.
Rob Kirby, please tell people more about the services you provide and what they'll find when they reach you.
Well, you can find a lot of educational material in archives at my site, and new material as it comes along. And you can catch me on the web at KirbyAnalytics.com.
Going to look forward to having you back on the show.
Pleasure being with you, Chris.
This is Robert Ian with GoldSeek.com Radio. An article headline that recently appeared on the AARP website stated, IRS demands proof of health insurance, and the taxes filed in 2018 would require filers to indicate coverage. The article by Gary Strauss of AARP outlined how the IRS won't process individual tax returns in 2018 unless taxpayers indicate whether they have health insurance coverage or an exemption. In other words, this change makes 2018 the first time the IRS will not accept tax returns that omit this information, which one might suspect could potentially lead to other kinds of penalties, like failure to file penalties, failure to pay penalties, plus interest, plus the normally sanctioned penalties for not having health insurance, which for 2017 is the higher of 2.5% of adjusted gross income, or $695 per adult and $347.50 per child under 18, with a family maximum of $2,085. So no matter how you slice it, the costs add up and quickly offset some or all of any refund a person may have coming. Thanks to a do-nothing Congress on health care, who would still rather argue like Monday morning quarterbacks and be against the outcome of the 2016 election, instead of putting on their big boy and big girl pants and standing for what they were elected to do for citizens of the United States, it now appears the IRS has also given up on any guidance from Congress in the form of actual laws. IRS spokesman Bruce Friedland said, "This process reflects the requirements of the Affordable Care Act and the IRS's obligation to administer the health care law. It also appears the IRS has decided to strictly enforce the Obamacare employer mandate for the first time since its inception, and will start handing out penalties to companies with 50 employees or more that fail to provide affordable insurance to full-time employees and dependents." I contend health care was the pivotal issue in the 2016 presidential election. People always vote their pocketbooks. 2018 will be no different. Congress, look out. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter at ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris.
Okay, Robert, thanks for another excellent installment. Well, that wraps up this week's GoldSeek.com radio episode. For two new big guests, be sure to check out next week's show. Until we talk to you again, have a great week.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.